I'm Eli Nyberger. I'm the Associate Director of IT and Production here at the Ann Arbor District Library. And I just want to thank you all for coming out tonight. When I put this on the calendar, I didn't really think about how almost everybody is going to be out of town or at a picnic or that kind of thing today. But here we are, and we're going to have a good time tonight. So one thing is that we are recording tonight's program. So if you have questions for any of our presenters this evening, I'll come around with a microphone just so we can be sure to get your question on the tape. Okay, so I've just got a couple slides to kind of introduce this topic and talk about why we think this is important and why we've, here at the library, dedicated resources to making it happen. One thing that's interesting to think about is that, you know, there was, you know, America has a long, rich tradition of making and building and tinkering and doing things, and it used to be there were all kinds of publications that were focused on this market and were designed to do this. And you see here's a couple of early 50s Popular Mechanics and Popular Science. You can see on Popular Mechanics, robot TV sites, forest fires, For the Craftsman, build your own portable barbecue. Popular Science, how to build a beginner's diving outfit. And you can see there's his friend pumping it up on the surface. Not the sort of thing that most DIYers get into these days. But what is interesting is you start to see the direction that these went in, the 54 Ford and what we think of it. They started to discover there was a new type of customer, someone who wanted to read about upcoming commercial products. And that turned out to be a very significant audience for them. The other issue is that as they went through the late 50s, they started getting dominated by a certain type of cover. Race to the Moon, Are the Russians Ahead? And How Deadly Are the Russian Jets? This is what sold magazines. This is what was able to move them. What's most interesting about this is that then for the next 50 years, it didn't really change. These are two copies of the same magazines from 2000. We have Rogue Nukes, We're Betting Everything on a National Defense System, and Inside Russia's Secret Rocket Complex. You look at other covers from that, and it's like, here are the 20 new cars from this age. They don't even talk about how to build anything yourself anymore. They don't even give any instructions. It's all just about what products are coming out, where you can buy them, and which are the best ones. This was a very big change. So enter these two guys. This is Dale Dougherty and Tim O'Reilly. Now, Tim O'Reilly and the two of them together founded O'Reilly Publishing back in, I think the late 80s. And they write basically computer books. And, you know, you may have seen them. They're the ones that have these beautiful woodcuts or lithographs of various animals on the cover. And those animals have become synonymous with some of those technologies. For example, if you're going to learn Perl, you can't, if you're going to learn Perl, you can't do so without the camel book. That's what it's been called, the camel book. So these guys were enormously influential. Dale Dougherty actually coined the term Web 2.0. Now, he was the first person to use that term, and also he was the first person to have a website that was supported by advertising. So these guys are real web pioneers. And somewhere along the way, they started realizing that this whole sort of culture of making things and building things and tinkering things had kind of disappeared from mainstream media in the United States. So they created Make Magazine. And Make Magazine is really a throwback to what some of these magazines were like back in the 10s and 20s when you had to make these things yourselves because you couldn't afford the real products. You can see they got Adam Savage on the cover building a hydrogen oxygen rocket or 10 sneaky spy gadgets. And none of the stuff in here is about upcoming products, unless they're products that you then use to build something out of. Like Arduino is probably the most popular example, which is a little solid-state circuit that you can program to do all kinds of different things. So when those sorts of things come out, Make Magazine gets really excited about it. You can see one of the things, build a pole camera there, is to put a way to mount a little digital camera on top of a pole and be able to take very unique pictures at big public events. There was actually one of those at the Mini Maker Faire. So not long after they started publishing Make, they had this wonderful event called Maker Faire. And you may have heard of Eepy Bird. Eepy Bird are these two guys who do the Diet Coke and Mentos fountains. Have you seen these guys? We're going to jump to this video here and take just a quick look at what Maker Faire kind of looks like. And then we'll come back to this. So I don't know if you saw that giant hand. The giant hand is controlled by a person wearing a glove. This guy built this huge hand out of it. So this has been going on in the Bay Area for, I think, 4 years, 4 4 or 5 years. And it's just basically people building weird things. And of course, a lot of this stuff also goes to Burning Man, as you can imagine. And just kind of building weird things and doing strange things. And they invited the Eepy Bird guys to come and do their show. So part of the exciting thing that happened when, about a year ago, just a little over a year ago, Dale Dougherty came to Ann Arbor to give a speech for the Merit Annual Conference, and he also visited GoTech, which is a local group of people who are interested in this kind of stuff and like to build things together. And then he also came here and he gave a talk about the maker culture and the history of making in America. And we did record that. That's available on AADL.TV if you want to watch Dale's talk from last year. And one of the things that came up when he was here is that there was kind of this interest in getting Maker Faire to get away from the coasts and kind of come into the middle of America. They had done one in Austin, but they hadn't done anything in kind of the upper Midwest. And one thing that Dale had realized when he was out here is that there's a lot of skill in the Detroit metro area. But a lot of that skill is seen as being attached to an employer. And that, you know, you have these skills and abilities and you're just waiting for an employer to come and pay you for them. But in reality, that's not the way that the majority of American entrepreneurship has worked, and that a lot of it over the years has been people who come up with an idea and make it into their own business, not necessarily just working on a line. But we've worked that way in Michigan for so long, it's become easy to forget sort of the maker roots. So, between O'Reilly and Make Magazine and the Henry Ford, they decided to do a Maker Faire here in Detroit, calling it the Motor City Faire. And that's coming up at the end of July. And the Diet Coke and Mentos guys are going to be there. They're coming and bringing their show. Another thing that they've got is a full-size mousetrap board. You know the mousetrap board game where if you set it up. They've built a full-size one that is human-scaled. All kinds of other interesting things and exhibits. Lots of Detroit area makers exhibiting their own stuff. So alongside this is a couple of other little institutions and organizations you should be aware of here in the Ann Arbor area. One is the A2 Mech Shop. This is a place where people who like to make things can basically rent space and be a part of a shared making space and a shared making environment. They have tools there and they all kind of use the tools together. There's a couple different businesses that operate out of there, and it's a new type of model. It's very similar to the Workantile Exchange, which you may be familiar with over on Main Street. It's a place where you can buy a membership and have a place to just go sit and work that isn't a cafe. It's also a cafe, but it's not only a cafe. So the Workantile Exchange is a very cool place and very much a model of the way that sort of post mega industrial employment is likely to happen. And Mech Shop is just like that, only for people who make things out of metal and styrofoam and wood as opposed to zeros and ones. The other institution here in town is All Hands Active, which is the downtown hackerspace. This is in the same space as Digital Ops, which is the gaming, I guess you call it a gaming salon, over on Liberty, right next to the Michigan Theater. All Hands Active has a lot of youthful vigor and energy. They have a lot of cool ideas, and they just want to make a space where people can make cool things. So this was for the Ann Arbor Mini Maker Faire, that the second one happened just a couple of weeks ago. This is the cybernetic juggler, and what she has is she's got balls of tinfoil, and she has sensors in her hands, and depending on which ball she's holding, different little electronic parts on her back wiggle around when she has the different balls in her hands. Very unusual and very cool exhibit. And, you know, they also built just a big cardboard fort for all the kids. So the idea is being, again, there's not enough of this hands-on education. There's not enough of this idea that you can make things yourself. So they're trying to bring that back. There's also a number of businesses based in the Ann Arbor area that have sort of taken this to the next level. One of the biggest successes right now is a Current Motor Company, which is still, I believe, housed at the Mech Shop, and they make all electric scooters. And it's a very serious, real product made right here in Ann Arbor. And this is a very cool thing. There's actually, if you walk on Main Street, Barclays has one of these sitting in their window right next to Espresso Royale. Also, there's a guy in town named Pete Jensen, and he has a business called TubeClock.com, and he makes clocks out of Nixie tubes. And Nixie tubes were these older vacuum tubes that could display the numbers 0 through 9 with a little set of shaped incandescent elements. So Peter Jensen makes these clocks out of these old Nixie tubes, and they are really very cool devices. One of our programmers here at AADL has one on his desk, and they're super awesome. But just another example, he's taking some old tech, some new tech, integrated circuits on the inside that drive them, and putting them together to make something new and decorative and functional. So before I move on to our presenters for the evening, I just want to let you know about a couple things that are happening here at the library. In conjunction and support with Maker Faire, we've made our summer reading theme Make It Happen, because we want the kids to realize that summer isn't just about sitting on your butt reading books. It's also about making things and doing things and having fun experiences. So we've got a couple of different things. One is, in conjunction with All Hands Active, we're doing this thing called Rec Lab and Make Lab. And it's at the first time that we had the first one this past Thursday, and a bunch of young kids came and took apart a bunch of old LCDs at the school. The library doesn't use anymore. And then on tomorrow night, they're going to come and make something new out of them. We also have our second make lab and rec lab is about clothing. We'll get a lot of Salvation Army clothing and take it apart and then stitch new things together. And then the last one is about making art out of unused computer components, hard drives and other boards and all that kind of stuff. So those are very fun events. They are open to all ages. You can find out more about that on our website. Also, this Saturday right here in this room is Gundam Fest. Gundam is a huge world-spanning Japanese giant robot show, and they are all about building models and watching shows, so we're going to have 50 Gundam kits for kids to try out. So the first 50 kids who come will all get their own Gundam kit to put together. And one thing that's amazing, if you've ever put together like Revell, Snaptite, or any of the American model kits, boy, those Japanese model kits are just amazing in terms of the quality of the engineering, how easy they are put together, without even having to read any of the non-English instructions. You can follow the pictures and put it all together, so that's great. Then, this Sunday, we have an event called Build the Bit Dragon. This is the library's exhibit for Maker Faire. We're making this big, long dragon out of 5-gallon buckets, and it'll be used in parades. So the kids can actually decorate, or adults as well, can decorate the bucket segments, and we've been putting CDs on it to make like the dragon scales and all that kind of stuff. Then, Wednesday, 7/14, we have the History of Mechanical Television. That's featuring Suzanne Fisher, who is a curator of business technology at the Henry Ford. And she's going to be talking about all of the pre-cathode ray experiments at transmitting moving images. There were these several different mechanical display technologies that were dominant in a very small market before it really caught on big. And then finally, Maker Faire at the Henry Ford is at the end of July. So I hope you'll check out all that stuff. There's Maker Faire flyers in the back. So, I've got four presenters lined up for you this evening. First, I'm going to introduce Dan Romanchik, and he's going to talk a little bit about ham radio in Ann Arbor and what's going on at the Hands-On Museum. So, please join me in welcoming Dan Romanchik.
Well, thank you very much. I'm Dan Romanchik, and my amateur radio call sign is KB6NU. When you get an amateur radio license, you get a unique identifier, and oftentimes we are known by our identifiers more than our names even. So ham radio operators like to call ourselves the original geeks. Ham radio has been around a long time, almost 100 years, if not 100 years already. And so we like to claim this being the original geeks. I guess you can say the steam engine guys probably are a little bit earlier, but we're pretty close. Ham radio operators do a lot of things, but I wanted to, because we're talking about making stuff, I'm going to focus on actually making stuff rather than the other kind of activities we do. But I will mention just a few of them. One of them is emergency and public service communications. We do a lot of that, but that's not the point of the talk, so I'll just blow over that a little bit quickly. We say ham's home brew. By that I mean just like you homebrew beer, you make beer at your home, we make radios in our home. And that's been a long tradition of that. As Eli pointed out, in the early days, you had to do it yourself. There were no commercial products, so you had to do it yourself. Even today, some hams make it a point to build all their own equipment. And I contact those kind of guys frequently. I'm not one of them, but you do contact them. The one who's really probably the most known these days is a ham whose call sign is AA1TJ. And he's got a number of different creations if you go to his website. But this one he calls the Das Derelict. And you can see the prototype there. It's built on a prototype board. What you do with that is you stick the components into the little holes, and the little holes connect all the components. All those components came out of a burned-out compact fluorescent light bulb. And that's actually a little transmitter. And I actually contacted him when he was using that transmitter. And he estimates it puts out 100 milliwatts of power. 100 milliwatts. I mean, that's like nothing. And yet he's in Vermont, and he was able to talk to me here in Michigan. So that was pretty cool. I when I talked to him about that, I thought that was pretty neat. If you're not quite up to doing it all yourself, you can build kits. There's lots of kits. I build lots of kits. Here's an example of a kit I built. This is a whole self-contained amateur radio transceiver. It's got a transmitter and receiver built into it. A couple other kits. I want to apologize for not having pictures, but I've been without internet connection for about a day and a half, so I wasn't able to get pictures. This is a little kit I built. This is a little device that helps you align and test receivers. And this is a little kit that a friend of mine and I actually designed. This is a device you'd use to test like feed lines for your antenna and stuff like that. But you see how simple these really are. You can build these in an evening, and at the end of the evening, you've got a useful little piece of test equipment. So that's kind of cool. Kits are available in a wide variety, from, like I say, the real simple to the more sophisticated. And there's even some that are even a lot more sophisticated than this yet. And there's actually a Michigan connection. I don't know how many of you are old enough to know about Heathkit. But Heathkit used to be a company in Benton Harbor, Michigan. And when I was a kid, that's the way a lot of us got into amateur radio, by building Heathkits. Heathkit produced a lot of different kits, a lot of test equipment. You could build your own television set, a lot of radios, stuff like that. Then they got into computers, and when computers were first around, they had a bunch of computer kits, and actually that sort of led to the demise of the company. They got bought out by bigger companies, and they basically trashed the Heathkit part of it, unfortunately. One of the knocks on ham radio is that it's old technology. I mean, we have been around 100 years, but part of the... written right into the law that establishes amateur radio is this statement: hams are supposed to advance the state of the radio art. That's the exact way it's worded. And we take that seriously. In recent years, we've come up with lots of new things. One thing we call the digital modes. That's where we connect computers to radios and use the computer to modulate the signal and demodulate the signal. Using digital signal processing, sometimes we can communicate even when you can't hear it with your ear. You may not be able to hear that signal, but that computer is going to pull that signal right out of the mud. It's really pretty sophisticated. There's also a thing called software-defined radio. And in a software-defined radio, what you do is you turn that radio signal into, you digitize it. You turn it into a set of numbers, and then you use software to implement functions that normally circuits would in a radio. And that's probably the latest frontier in radio. Satellite communication: amateurs send up satellites. They piggyback on commercial and scientific rocket launches, and there's a number of satellites up in the air right now, and we can communicate by bouncing signals off them. Amateurs themselves. There's a group called the AMSAT, and it's short for amateur satellites, and we all chip in and they send them up. Also, you know, we're also part of the internet revolution. We use voice over IP in some cases. The two most popular systems, if you will, are called Echolink and IRLP. And what these do is there are local stations called repeater stations. And if you had a handheld radio, normally you'd talk through this repeater station to other people in the local area. The repeater station gives you a bigger range because usually it's up on a tall building and it gives you a greater range. But some hams have actually taken those signals, routed it into the internet, goes throughout the whole world, out another repeater on the other side of the world. And so then with a little handheld radio, you can be talking to someone in Dublin, Ireland, Tokyo, Japan, if you knew Japanese, wherever. One of my friends has a brother who lives in Austin, Texas, or Corpus Christi, Texas, and he used to live in Thailand. And he regularly gets on IRLP and talks to his friends in Thailand via the internet. So that's kind of cool. How do you become a ham? Well, there are three different classes of licenses, tech, general, and extra. And as you go from the lowest to the highest, you get more what we call more privileges. You get to use more frequencies and more types of transmit different ways. And you take a fairly simple multiple choice test. The technician and the general are 35 questions. The extra is a little harder and takes 50 questions. One of the big stumbling blocks in the past has been the Morse code test requirement. But as of about 10 years ago, the code test was eliminated for the technician class. And now, as of 2 or 3 years ago, there's no Morse code test required at all now. So if you're thinking, oh no, I got to take Morse code, don't worry about that. I personally love Morse code. I use it all the time, but that's me. Here in Ann Arbor, we have volunteer examiners who give the test every month. So it's very easy to find a person to give you the test. And at the Hands-On Museum, we have an amateur radio station, and we actually teach classes there too. We teach classes 3 or 4 times a year there, and we teach what's called the one-day tech class. And we actually do. We get you your license in one day. We go from 9 till 3, and basically we cram the material into you, and right at 3 we get the volunteer examiners there to give you the test so you don't forget anything. And we have a very good success rate. The last two sessions we had 29 people in all. We had a 100% pass rate. Overall, the last 2 or 3 years we've had probably close to 90% pass rate. So we do a pretty good job with that. And plus, at the Hands-On Museum, like I said, we have this station there, and it's very cool. We just go there and play with radios and build stuff and just have a lot of fun. I'm usually there most every Saturday, and just stop by, and we'll give you a real demonstration of ham radio. And don't even have to worry about paying a fee. Just tell me you're with the Ham Radio Club, and they'll let you right in. For more information, you can go to these two websites. The first is the American Radio Relay League. They're the National Association for Amateur Radio Operators. And then this is me. My claim to fame is I have the number one ham-rated ham radio blog on Google. So if you type in ham radio blog into Google, I'm number one. But that's my website. And I have a study guide there if you want to take the test. And here's my email address. If you have any questions at all about ham radio, just feel free to email me, or you need to look me up in the phone book and call me. So. Sure. Well, there's two theories on that. One is it's just sort of a shortened form of amateur, and so that's one theory. What I tend to like is that back in the early days, it was all Morse code. Okay, because they hadn't really invented voice modulation yet. And so you had professional telegraphers, right? Even before radio, you had landline telegraphy. So you had guys that were really good at sending. Well, now you got these amateurs in there, and maybe they're not quite so good. And, like ham actors, these guys, they call them ham operators. So that's the theory I kind of tend to go with.
Dan, what's the most exciting or memorable conversation that you've had with someone over
ham radio? Good question. Well, I'll tell you an experience that was memorable to me. Not so much a contact, but every year we have a thing called Field Day, and Field Day is sort of the quintessential amateur radio event. It's a combination of emergency preparedness exercise, an amateur radio contest where you try and make as many contacts as you can with as many people. And it's a PR event. We invite politicians and public service agencies to come and see what ham radio can do. So it's all these things sort of rolled into one. And last year, we had a kid come up, and he had this is the first time he'd seen ham radio, and he was so excited that he was shaking. And it was amazing. And then his mother tells me, well, he already knows Morse code. So I took him over to one of the Morse code stations, and sure enough, this kid knew Morse code, and he did it all by listening to this radio he had. He had a little handheld radio, and he learned the Morse code himself by just listening to the radio. And not only did he know Morse code, he knew it at like 30 words a minute, which is pretty fast. So we were able to, over the last year, we were able to get him his license, get on the air, and that's been a cool experience for me.
Any other questions?
Well, thanks.
All right, thanks a lot, Dan. Okay, our next presenter tonight is Curtis Glatter, and he is a amateur musician and professional musician here in the Ann Arbor area. I'm going to pull up his MySpace page here.
There we go.
Okay, so please join me in welcoming Curtis Glatter.
I just wanted to thank Eli for having me out today. I really do appreciate the opportunity to speak to y'all. I've been performing and composing for about 25 years. I started playing when I was about 8 years old, started playing percussion. I'll just keep it real brief. I'm originally from Michigan, originally from Dearborn Heights. I've traveled all over the world, haven't hit the Asian countries yet, but I've traveled quite a bit, seen a lot of different performances, a lot of different ways to make music. What I do is something called electroacoustic chamber music. And what that is it's the ability for musicians to interact with technology. It's been going on for the last 100 years. But it's a style of creating three forms of music, which is one pre-recorded. It's also scored music, which is written down. And it's also the ability to perform improvisations over that music. So there's three layers of creating music when that happens. It sounds very complicated, but if you have an idea for music, for example, and you want to construct it, there's one gentleman that had a huge influence on my music, which was Frank Zappa. He said the way to make music is just to start something and stop something, and that is your music, be it a bird, if you want to recreate a bird call, or if you want to recreate a train, or if you want to create a guitar solo, anything like that. So some of the influences that I've had is Laurie Anderson, Frank Zappa, Grigory Ligeti, Steve Reich, John Zorn, some local musicians that have also been able to influence me are jazz musicians, not so much electronics. I got mostly into that from John Cage and some of the guys from 1950s that were doing electronic music, basically sampling objects. Like cactuses, sampling objects like windstorms, sampling objects like trees crashing to the ground. All of that can be created and, in fact, manipulated to create music. So what I wanted to talk to you about tonight is something called Inotronic 2010, which is a booth that I'm going to be presenting at the Ann Arbor, or I should say at the Detroit City Maker Fair. They said that they were turning Detroit City into Maker City on this particular date of July the 31st and August 1st, and it's at the Henry Ford. And what my booth consists of is actually three elements: car parts, a laptop, and also a laptop computer, and also a amplifier. That's all I'm going to use to create music. Basically, the reason I'm presenting it is to show everybody that comes to this particular event that anybody and everybody can make music no matter what they have in their backyard. They can make it out of buckets. You can make music out of buckets. You can make music out of hardware that you find. What I'm going to be doing is actually creating live music. So it's not going to be anything that's pre-recorded. It will be sampled, manipulated, and also you'll be able to interact with a laptop. So that means I'll be controlling the laptop. All you have to do is play whatever you see in front of you. I will sample it. I will manipulate it higher or lower. I will reverse it and play it back to you, and I will be able to improvise it, and I will let you guys improvise it if you come to see the booth. So it'll be very interactive, very fun, and I'll give I'll be giving away CDs, things as far as creating also a chance for you to create your own household items to perform on and take home with you. The other events, actually, that I have been working with are other musicians that are involved with jazz improvisation. The way that I construct music in any circumstance when it comes to electronics or tech equipment is basically to find out what the jazz musicians want to hear and to be able to manipulate the sounds that they've already created and trying to create something that's new and original with a laptop. And it's no particular music program that you have to use. You can use a basic laptop. You just put up a microphone in front of your laptop. You just push the record button, push the stop button, you play it back. It's just like using a tape recorder. But it actually does interact with other musicians by recording them. So they're actually amazed that as an improvising musician, you can use just a regular laptop. The reason that I decided to do a 5-minute presentation today is not only for the Maker Faire, but also I'll be giving a full-on presentation on the 9th here at the Ann Arbor Library. And also on the 23rd, I'll be playing the Ann Arbor Art Fair at 2 o'clock. So if you guys have any questions about what I do or would like to maybe hear any of the music, it's possible to hear some of it on the website. You've probably, maybe, perhaps been wondering how electronic music has evolved. And it's actually evolved through a lot of recording of old radio programs and also through Hammett radio, as Adam was saying, by basically performing with signals from around your local area or signals from around the country. You can actually create, sample, and project all of these sounds onto a concert stage with other musicians that are classically trained, jazz trained, African trained, or trained in any other culture. And they're not segregated from the idea of using technology. You'll find out that when you start using electronics with other musicians and jazz and rock and classical and different backgrounds, they're actually interested because you're using a piece of technical equipment that you usually check your email or create a web program or do word processing on to create music, and people are usually very delighted by that. If you want, I could take questions about anything that I've been doing, or if you'd like to maybe ask about me personally, why I keep doing it, even though people really, you know, are not quite sure what it is that I do, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I've got a question. Sure. What music has been shaped by so many inventions. What invention of the 20th century do you think has had the biggest impact on the direction that music has taken?
Well, the good and bad news is that the invention of the iPod and the invention of sampling music has had the biggest impact on music. The reason being is that in order for a musician to make money these days, they do have to create records and they do have to sell records. And of course, there's big corporations that produce big bands, so on and so forth. But in order to be an original musician or original composer or original at anything, you have to give or talk to people personally about what you do. You have to play for people personally. So the amount of money that I ask for as a person-to-person, like I'm going to be performing here, I'm going to be performing here, has gone up because of the invention of pirating music. Because anybody can sit down and put on a CD, and anybody can dial up you on their internet or iPod, but to physically show up as a human being and being able to play for somebody and actually get that reaction from somebody saying, I didn't know you could do that. I had no idea that you could create music out of nothing or create music out of just a bucket. Or I had no idea that you could just show up with nothing in your hands and interact with other jazz musicians. And that's, to me, what the development of technology has become, like a constant pirating and masking of other people's material, but there's not a lot of new material coming out. So by combining all that material that's happened in the last 1,000 years, from African percussion all the way up to 20th century just bleeps and bloops that you hear from R2-D2 on Star Wars, all that can be combined to make music that can actually be your own personal stamp on music history. And anybody can do it. Oh, that's a great question. Favorite non-traditional instrument? I do play coffee cans quite a bit, actually. The coffee cans are used just like a regular drum set would be used. I know a lot of kids, when they grow up, they bang on pots and pans. But I've actually performed on a couple records where they said, no, I don't want you to use your drums or keyboards or sandpaper. I want you to use this set of coffee cans, and I want you to create a rhythm track out of these coffee. And so they just give me 10 coffee cans, and I just go to town, and they're excited to hear what comes out. So that's what's exciting to me, to see if that challenge can come. I'm really excited to be able to, you know, perform on that. Yeah, sure.
I'm interested, you know, as the economics of being a musician have obviously gotten tougher. But do you feel that more people feel empowered to make music than when you started as a musician because of, you know, having more democratized?
I haven't seen more people eager to create more original music. I've seen more people willing to give themselves over to music that's been going on for the last 300-400 years, whatever style it is, either Latino or American rock or classical. They're more willing to say, well, if they can do it, I can do it. If they're professionally trained, if they go to this university, then they obviously are trained at what they do. But I get that question all the time when I go to play at a university. They say, are you officially trained? And I say, yes, I'm officially trained in university. Then why do you play on these coffee cans? Or why do you play on these boxes? Or why do you make music on a laptop? It doesn't make sense. And I say, well, is anybody else doing it? Is there anybody else that's willing to, you know, put those kind of ideas out there? And they say, yeah, but how much money is in it? And that's always the next question. How much money is it in doing this? Well, if you do it enough, there's two rules to being a composer or any kind of great inventor. There's don't stop and keep going. That's the two rules you have to keep, you know, and eventually people will catch up. And just like, you know, Henry Ford, like, you know, that's one example where he had an idea, just eventually he kept creating these things, and lo and behold, it revolutionized the entire industry of automobiles.
Any other questions?
Sure, sure. One of these, this Suite Tempestra opening titles is actually all done on laptop. If you would like to maybe, I don't know, play it. I haven't used this in a while, let's see. Well, it's a form of repeating the original pattern, which you hear this high-pitched ba-dum-bum, bum-ba-dum. It's slowly fading out, but there's three notes motives. Basically, in the very beginning of it, it's really quiet. So it's a matter of repeating that motive over and over again just by... None of it was played on a melodic instrument, just to let you know. One particular program called Finale, there's another program called Catwalk, there's another program called Sibelius. Basically, I wrote a piano piece, and the piano piece was very rarely played. So I decided to use the cursor, and because it had autoplay on it, that means that the computer will automatically play what's on the bar, or automatically play the music that's being performed. I used the mouse to retrograde, go backwards, and go forwards over that particular bar line. That's live music, but the horn is actually a real horn player. But the percussion in the background is me with an electronics guy that actually just plays keyboards and electronics. And that was all written out by something called sketch music. Some people read score music, and some people read sketch music. If you're talented enough to read sketches, God bless you. But if you're not really familiar with the term of sketch music, it's just basically drawings on a page. And if you're able to follow the highs and lows, the squiggles, the bleeps and the bloops, then, you know, you're in a rare league of people that understand it. But that particular sound that you hear now is duo buckets. So we both are reading a notated bucket part. So they're both steel buckets. This is a piece from a dance work, which is called Estuary Dances, which is six movements. This is the first movement of the piece. Anyway, I think I'm going a little bit long, but I thank you all for listening. I really do appreciate it. And hopefully, if you get a chance to come out to the Maker Faire, that'd be wonderful. And if you get a chance to come out on August 9th, I'll be able to show you everything that I do physically. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, and then our next presenter is Larry Seiden. Am I saying that right, Seiden? And Larry's got a web project that he's going to show us. So please join me in welcoming Larry.
So back in the fall, I think it was September, October, I got a message on an email list that I subscribe to. I go to these lunches every Thursday. Some of you guys might be interested. Called A2B3, Ann Arbor Bebop. We meet at Asian Accents. And somebody who doesn't actually go to the lunches said that they were, or I think it was probably just Ed Vilmetti, who writes for AnnArbor.com, was just kind of forwarding these messages that somebody was looking for a volunteer programmer to do a calculator for the University of Michigan Senior Housing Bureau. And later I sat down and met with her, and she wasn't actually from the Bureau. She was from an organization called FINRA that deals with financial readiness, basically educating the public for financial readiness so people don't get taken advantage of, like by some of these home refinancing schemes that people got conned into before the mortgage bust. And also they were concerned about readiness for retirement. And that segues into the Housing Bureau, because one of the issues that the Housing Bureau is concerned about is the cost of senior assisted living. That when people are, usually it's the adult children of seniors who are doing this, they have to find a place for a parent that they can no longer take care of by themselves, and they all have bewildering arrays of initial costs, deposits, and then monthly costs. They're all structured differently. Some meals are included, others meals are extra. The costs for all kinds of different care that they need if they have continence issues or memory issues. And they wanted a calculator that would help people evaluate them and be able to compare them very quickly, because they said that once they actually start comparing the cost of these places, very quickly they realize that they can only afford one or two of them. And it's very sobering. So I just brought with me, this is some material that they gave me, that they prepared, showing the various costs and fee structures of some of the facilities in the area. And they, I wouldn't go over it here, but they just, each one has its own fee structure, and it's just kind of bewildering. So I kind of struggled with it for a while. I was wondering, like, how am I going to possibly present and organize this in a calculator for people. Finally, I realized that there is no one-size-fits-all, that it has to be very, I was told not to touch that. Yeah. I was, I'm not good at following directions. I had to make it very, very open-ended. So the first page just deals with people's own financial condition, their assets, income, and expenses. And then they go, that's the My Finances part, and then they have the living options. And here we have different options. We can you can actually rename them. You could type something else if you wanted to. And this is showing you the number of years that a person would be able to stay in each of these options that they're considering. Option meaning they wanted me to use the word option instead of facility, because one of the options could be living in your own home. In that case, you would have the initial cost would be like renovations that somebody would have to do, like a wheelchair ramp or some kind of a lift on the stairs if they have upstairs and downstairs. You know, bathroom improvements to allow a person to, you know, with disabilities to enter and get around. And then it's also sensitive to interest rates, because I wanted to do something that would be like kind of like a financial calculator, that because you know a person could require to be in, you know, none of us really know how long we're going to live, so it could be, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. So we need to take inflation and return on investments into account if the people have investments that they have that they can make any money from. It doesn't take into account, for example, it can't take into account different financial scenarios. For example, if a person lives long enough, eventually their assets will run out or deplete, and they'll have to go on, I think it's not Medicaid. I was thinking of, I think maybe it is Medicaid. I forgot the term. Or they start getting certain Social Security benefits. Basically, at that point, they become a ward of the government, of the state. And then the resources are completely depleted. And that's really what this is all about. We want to find out how long we will be able to go on in each of these facilities if, God forbid, we live long enough, we live that long. I have a friend whose parents are in his 90s right now, and that's a very real concern of him and his siblings, is how to continue to care for them financially when they can no longer care for themselves and their own assets are basically running out. Let me see. This is just a demo site. The real site I'm still working on is to connect it with a database. The database I'm hosting on a place called Heroku. I could go there now, but I don't think it's necessary. The back end is the data storage part is written in Ruby, and it's hosted on Heroku. is a place that hosts various Ruby apps, and they give you a database. And right now, I just bootstrapped the whole thing on a shoestring budget. It's all, I think my account on Heroku is free, and when they go to log on to it, they can log on with their Google or Yahoo or Flickr or Facebook accounts. That's through a different website called RPX Now. One of the things about this, and this is where my own self-interest comes in, I decided after kind of talking to the ladies at the Senior Housing Bureau that the real value in this to me would be gathering this data. That if I can store this data in a way that doesn't compromise people's privacy, then I could license it to various either non-for-profit institutes and for-profit. For example, the very people who are running these facilities who would be interested to know, for example, you know, how many people in certain zip codes have been using this tool, and what are their, you know, what are their financial assets look like? But again, I want to emphasize that I'm not one of the reasons I'm using other providers like Yahoo and Flickr and so on is that I don't want to be in the business of storing people's identities or passwords or managing them. All I'm getting back is an identifier that wouldn't make any sense to anybody, and I'm hashing that, and that's what I'm saving in the database. So next time they come in, and they want to go back to their page, that's what it identifies them with. It doesn't actually keep their email, it doesn't know their address, it doesn't know anything about them. Eventually, I'm probably going to combine this with a survey that'll ask them again very general, non-personal questions like gender, age, zip code. You know, how many children do they have, and so on. Just getting an idea of their overall financial health and how socially connected they still are. Can they do their own shopping? Does somebody need to do it for them? Things like that, and then combining it with this data, I think it would be very valuable for researchers. But I haven't got there yet. I'll probably at that point, I'll probably need a partner to help me market it, who understands this kind of business. That's basically it. I did the interface itself with a tool called SproutCore. I guess I can go to that site. And this is just the front page, and it's a library. It's completely written in JavaScript. So I almost wrote absolutely no HTML to create this page. It's all done in JavaScript. The lead programmer on the project is a guy named Charles Jolly. I think of Jolly Roger whenever I hear his name. And I think he's a ex-Apple person. And it was done by a bunch of people from Apple. I think they were doing a lot of stuff with Cocoa, which is I think has to do with handhelds. And this is also supposed to be compatible with handhelds. Not my app, but it's very easy to make another version of it that would be handheld compatible that I intend to do eventually. And it's done so that each time they change something in a field, there's other fields that are basically listening. And so when something changes, like if I add a cost here, like we'll type, I don't know, 3,000, and then we'll see that 11.8 years should change to something else. So that was exactly what I needed, and I found out by going to another talk and hearing somebody else in town named Kevin Dangler, who's done a lot of work with JavaScript. He was the one who recommended this framework to me. And it was kind of, I just jumped into it in the deep end, and I had no idea what I was getting into. I mean, it's very new, it's very undocumented. I think they just recently released their first official version, so it was I had to learn a lot of stuff as I went along, and I had to talk to people over the IRC channel and on the Google group for it. So that's basically it. That's where it's at right now, and I hope to connect it soon with the database, so it'll be able to go live.
Any questions for Larry? Okay, thank you very much. Our last speaker this evening is Philip Profrock, who is a local architect and actually worked on the library's Mallets Creek and Pittsfield buildings. So please join me in welcoming Philip Profrock.
Hi, I am Philip Profrock, and I am interested in talking a little bit this evening about residential design with shipping containers. I should point out that none of the images that I have here are my own work. This is just something that I've started to experiment and explore a little bit. But the idea of using shipping containers as an inexpensive green platform for residential experimentation has been around for a few years, and there are some examples that are already in place. It's a very green option because there are thousands of shipping containers that are being produced every year for international shipping, and they stack up by the hundreds and the thousands in the ports of countries that are receiving goods from other countries. So on the West Coast, in the ports of Seattle and Portland and Los Angeles and Long Beach, there are thousands and thousands of these. There are hundreds of them in the Detroit area because of the auto manufacturing that's in this area. And as an armature for construction, they are very useful. They are designed to sit open on the decks of ships coming across the sea. So they're enclosed, they're relatively watertight, they're relatively sturdy. They are stacked up as many as 8 high, oftentimes. And they're relatively inexpensive. This is kind of a minimal model and not a particularly attractive. This is nothing more than 3 20-foot containers set up as a hunting cabin. There's no plumbing, there's no lighting, there's no heat, but it's a place to store stuff. Shipping containers are being used as construction site structures, on-site storage, and that's one of the versatile aspects that they offer is you could start out on a site with just a shipping container. It's designed to be locked, store your stuff there, and the idea that as you go along, the structure of it evolves as you build onto it, you open it up and stop using it as just a storage shed, but begin using it as the facility. There are a lot of examples of shipping container houses that get away from actually looking like shipping containers. And so much of it is cut away, as you can see in this. The sides are completely taken out and replaced with glass, and it makes for a nice image, but it kind of gets away from the basic nature of the inexpensive box as the basis. And it's nice, but it's expensive to do that. By cladding the exterior, you add a lot of material, and it basically takes on a nature of being something else. This is an example from Quebec, which, again, if you peer carefully into it, you can see the shipping containers there, but it's not immediately visible. But that doesn't have to be the case, and I think that there's a certain aesthetic in leaving the containers in their more basic form and letting that be seen. This is an example that was built a couple of years ago by an architect who has created a company based in Minnesota that is doing a lot of design of modular homes based on shipping containers. This was two small 20-foot long containers that he got for $800 a piece. He and his brother trucked them out into the woods and just set them up on some cribbing. They have no from the lighting, they now, in this image, have some solar power for the site so that they have a little bit of electricity there. But they started out with no water, no electricity. Everything was just what they could carry to the site. And they used the two containers and then built the structure in between them to get this minimal and yet attractive in its own way structure. There are certainly larger examples with shipping containers. This is an apartment in London and a retail store for a company called Freitag in Zurich. That's actually cut off a little bit. There are, I think there are actually four stories of shops in that, and then the tower above, which I don't think is actually inhabitable. But this is a company that makes handbags and other goods using recycled materials, and so the idea of recycling some of the shipping containers that were available was very much a part of what their company was about. They're maneuverable to a point. This is a construction of a structure that ended up using two shipping containers. These weigh 8,000 to 9,000 pounds, so they're not the sort of thing you can take home in a pickup truck, but on the other hand, with a little bit of construction equipment, it's not difficult to work with them, get them in place. I mentioned that they're fairly inexpensive. Dealing with a container such as this, which is 8 feet wide and 40 feet long, that's 320 square feet. If you can get a container like that used for $1,600, that's $5 a square foot. That's dirt cheap construction, and that makes a very affordable and viable platform to experiment with and work with something that isn't necessarily a full-scale family of four, family of five going to fit in that, but as a vacation cabin, something that can be experimented with, trying some things out without involving yourself in a lot of initial construction just to get to the point of being able to do some experimentation. And what this turns out to be is a cabin in the woods, a very nice effect. That's certainly, there are examples of that are going on. There's a competition underway right now. It's not, I don't believe, Habitat for Humanity, but another, maybe Architecture for Humanity is sponsoring a program. And that's certainly something that could be done. I think in a lot of instances, the issue is less one of the viability of it than it is having a location. The structure is cheap. The site preparation, all the additional work to get beyond just an open box to provide the other amenities that you'd need to make that livable are going to be at comparable cost. So it's not going to be that radical difference in cost from traditional housing, but dealing with a location, a city or a municipality, whatever, and saying we want to set up a community of these, you'd run into the same sort of issues you'd have doing anything with conventional construction. So I think that kind of political level is more the difficulty, that whether or not it's a good technology to use for that. They do sometimes fall in very rough seas, so I think they're not necessarily fastened together. This is still, I don't know the particulars of it. I'm still investigating that, but I think just the way that they are designed to nest together and the weight of them, you've got 8,000 pounds plus all the goods, and you can... the standard 40-foot container will hold, I believe it's about 20 tons of merchandise. So there's a fair amount of inertia wanting it to stay in place. But if there are really, really rough seas, there are instances of, there was an example that made its rounds on the internet where it was a shipping container full of rubber duckies that got knocked overboard and spilled, and scientists have been tracking the rubber duckies and finding out where the currents in the ocean flow from knowing the start point of this and seeing where they've gone.
What I heard about were sneakers.
Yeah.
Philip, I know a lot of building codes are written to be very specific for certain materials. Are there, are particular municipalities, quirks excluded, are there challenges with doing container building when it comes to local building codes?
I think that there probably would be some, I think zoning and kind of community acceptance of the industrial appearance as opposed to something clapboard-sided. I don't think that there's anything particular about the form of construction. It's basically a steel structure. So you can have, there's fundamentally nothing that much different from working with this as opposed to building a Butler building or a Morton building, you know, a pole barn. This one's a little bit more structural. I think anytime you have a case where there's some unconventional construction, you're probably going to be asked for more information from the code reviewing officials, but it should be a viable thing. I think that's also why in a lot of instances these are showing up as kind of cabins There are certainly instances of, you know, houses in town and apartments and so forth, but it's the sort of thing that's really well suited to being out someplace, kind of, it's one trip with a vehicle to drop it off and it's there rather than bringing a lot of materials. So it's got that going for it in terms of being able to reach a site only intermittently.
About the construction time from start to finish, for example, with just a basic structure, what would be the construction time? Would it be 3 to 6 months or 8 to 10 months? Or
I think that is, again, going to depend wildly on what you're doing. If you're working with a single structure, you'd have the possibility of, if you had a construction yard, which any small contractor would have, set it up in a corner of the space, build it out over time when you're able to, and load it onto a semi and take it. So you're, you know, however long you wanted to take building it out would be one thing, and then it's a matter of, you know, trucking it and a crane lifting it into place. So it could be something that was done kind of instantaneously, like other kinds of modular housing. Or to go back to the earlier example of this cabin in Minnesota, they trucked the containers out over a couple of weekends. They spent several weeks trying to figure out how to get them raised up and set in place. Their first attempt using one pickup, pulling it to try to pull it off of the trailer with the other pickup going in the other direction, ended up towing the other vehicle. So they had to work some things out. But then it was kind of just, you know, on weekends they would go up there and work on it over time.
Other questions?
It seems like the main advantage that you'd want out of this is, you know, just having a cheaper structure to build. But it seems like that goes out the window as soon as you start adding different amenities and you know, electricity and plumbing and all that. Are there any other advantages to using to building structures out of these containers?
It's an available resource, and so it's large scale recycling. You know, rather than using other virgin materials, you know, wood studs or metal studs or whatever. You're starting with the structure already in place. Some of the things that I've come across have talked about building costs. If you're going to build an entire house, working with the shipping containers as a structure could be 20 to 50% less. So it's not the radical. I mean, the raw square footage, as I said, can be very cheap, but the other parts of it still are going to be on par with more conventional construction. But there's the recycling aspect. Just from the standpoint of, again, if you're thinking of it in a remote location, it's well suited to kind of being abandoned and not being burgled or broken into the way if you were stick framing something and you had just your structure but kind of open to the elements. There's an architect based in the Pacific Northwest who's done a number of cabins in Wyoming, Montana, and he designs them they're on pieces of property that are subject to wildfire. And he's designed them so that the whole thing closes up with large metal shutters, and you have kind of a box that's somewhat fortified. That if nobody is there for a period of time, no one's going to be able to get into it. But also, if a fire comes through the area, it's also protected in that sense. So there are a couple of advantages there. It's not a panacea for everything, but there's some intriguing possibilities with it.
I guess one
Second question. You had showed up a picture of a fairly elaborate house before with a swimming pool. Is the swimming pool also made of one of the containers?
I think that it is. I don't recall specifically, but it looks to be about the same module as that part of the house behind it, and it doesn't look, from this perspective, like it has a shallow end.
Getting all the amenities like electricity and plumbing. What does it take as a practical matter to insulate them? Because I think a container can get awfully cold in the winter and awfully hot in the summer.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I'm interested in. At a very high end, there are now starting to be available nanogel insulation, which is very thin. Since you're working with a unit that's only 8 feet wide, if you insulated that to a reasonable thickness, you're going to start really impinging on the space that's there, and you end up with a hallway. Or you end up putting a couple of the boxes together, and you start cutting out the walls, and you're really destroying the integrity of the structure. But with a nanogel blanket, which is probably going to offset much of the price savings that you would have, you would be able to have just a quarter inch of material that would give you a comparable insulation or better insulation probably than what most contemporary houses have.
Any other questions?
Nanogel is a material that is also sometimes referred to as solid smoke. It's made from silica, and it is one of the lightest and strongest per unit of weight materials. And because it basically is it's a solid structure, so if you think of it as being like other kinds of extruded foam material, but there's much less material there and much more trapped air. So that gives it a insulation value that's very, very high because there's very little material to conduct any heat. But it's still a fairly expensive material to produce.
Is it rigid or is it something you can kind of...
It's fairly friable. It's kind of brittle. I've blogged a couple of articles about it, and I guess I'd probably point you to that. There's a, I think it was for jetsongreen.com earlier this year, there's an article about nanogel insulation, and you can find out some more about it from that.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much, Philip.
Okay, so thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. I hope you look forward to the rest of the events that we have going on this summer at the library. And our summer reading game is for not just kids, but for adults as well. So if you could please fill out a blue valuation form for us, let us know what you thought about this event and how we can make it better in the future. And thank you all very much for coming. Have a nice evening.